Good evening, everybody. My name is Mary Ann Dietrich, and I am an alcoholic.
What I'd like to say too is that by God's grace, I have not had a drink since June 22nd, 1976. And I'm your little firecracker for tonight. I'm your kickoff lead, I guess that's what they would call it. And I just celebrated with the help of God and Alcoholics Anonymous 22 years of uninterrupted sobriety, which is beautiful. You can imagine just to be crazy and sober as I am today, if you would have only known me then. But I'll try to take you back down that walk a little bit, but we all know what that kind of is like, and I don't want to forget, because I was told in the very, very beginning, those who forget are doomed to repeat, and I just have been graced. I was told in the beginning, the grace of God will take you where the will of God will keep you and keep you safe, and I have been graced. I was told in the very, very beginning, at 17 and a half years old, I was a little snot-nosed girl coming here to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was told that my sobriety was an unmerited gift from God. And I got very arrogant about looking at this guy when he said that, and it's true. What I did today to earn my sobriety is drive 4.5 hours to Columbus to see you all. And that is my, my giving back to AA. That is what I believe in doing, because my mother still, after all this time, says, "Why you gotta do that kind of stuff? Why, you know, I can't understand. You were at Sacred Heart Monastery last week, now you're going to Columbus this week. But I have to do this. This is what God wants me to do. And God wants me to share my experience, my strength, and my hope to you." I was told, "To much who is given, for much of him is expected." And I'm expected to do a lot here. Not that I'm some big shot in Alcoholics Anonymous. Believe me, I'm not. I'm just a little spoke on the wheel. And that's the way I like to keep it. I like to stay that way. Tonight, I'm your little firecracker and your start-off girl, and that's great and all fine and dandy. But this is just a group of drunks, and I'm a drunk. And I'm a recovered drunk. And when I say is recovered, I have recovered from this seemingly hopeless, helpless disease. And my disease is arrested only on a daily reprieve. So, yes, 22 years is a very, very long time, but it's only a one-day thing. And when we keep it broke down to this one-day thing, we can make this together. Certainly, the years you achieve a lot of things, and you do a lot of things, and you may accomplish a lot of things, but it's when you break it down to this one day at a time, it's sort of a humility act, because my sponsor told me too that in order to stay humble, you must always remain teachable, and so that's why I come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I have to learn. I learn from you, and I also learn from my mistakes as well. I also believe that a lot of people say to me, "Are you scared?" Well, yeah, I'm a little scared. I don't know anybody here. I don't know this area. I don't know where I'm driving. I turned this over to higher power, and I also turned it over to my girlfriend, who was my good orderly direction as well. And we got here with the help of her and my higher power, and Mickey's husband's half directions. I knew once that I got a mileage on 198, and we'd be all right. Once we hit Columbus, and we were like 190 something. I knew we were kind of close, but it was kind of a panic. At the last minute, we're pulling into Kroger's, and I'm yelling to this guy because we're baked like chickens, and I have a sunroof, and I'm. And I never take sun in. I only do ultraviolet. That's all I do. Ultraviolet. Never real sun. I was a sun baker a long time ago, but I was just so fried. And we pulled into Kroger's, and I'm like, "Hey, I care less about my anonymity. There's a Ramada Inn down here. It has a convention. Where is it?" And I am willing today to take some direction. And it's not only just from Alcoholics Anonymous, it's from other people as well. It doesn't have to be drunks or recovering people or whatever. It doesn't have to be that at all. And that's part of having humility. And the 12 steps were told to me that they were 12 steps to humility and also to humanity.
And that's how we grow in Alcoholics Anonymous, together. It's no cakewalk. When I came here, I suffered from what they talk about in the big book, that incomprehensible demoralization, you know, that whole, the person that I am, you know, that I drank, and it just was, you know, I picked up my first drink at maybe 15 or, I'm trying to think, maybe 15 or 16, and 15 and a half. And it was quite, pretty much over because the Beaver County Sheriff saw a fit to see me go to a rehabilitation center. And I didn't really think that I had a problem, but I thought it was everybody else around me. And of course, we always do. But the reality is that I had the problem. And thank God for the Beaver County Sheriff's and handcuffs and shackles and being civilly committed to a rehabilitation center, which is what has happened to me. And that was my experience. But I'm not saying that that needs to be everybody's experience, because some people just come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they get this thing, and it's, you know, for me, I had to get to a rehab. And I think that it was necessary for me to, you know, take a real good look at myself. I'm not saying that when I got to rehab, I worked the steps and I saw myself as who I really am, because it took me about a good 10 years. So if you're sitting there and you're 5 years sober and you think you've got to have it all together, sorry. I'm sorry. Wait till about 10 years, and then you might hear that pop. And you know what it is? It's your head coming out of your ass, and that's the bottom line. And they told me that at 5 years, and I think that's why they told me that at 5 years, because they thought I would keep coming back, because I was always looking for that reason why or how I felt. You know, I analyzed everything. I'm such an intellectual. And I was told by the old-timers, read the book. Read the book. Save yourself the heartache and read the book. And I just had a way about me being young and coming into AA. We have a lot to learn. And certainly it's just not being young. It's just all of us. And I, of course, thought I was an exception to the rule. I didn't think I needed to do these steps. I didn't think I needed to go to the meetings. I didn't think that I had to be humbled into myself. And I didn't think that I needed a God of my understanding. But the bottom line is that I needed all those things. And I slowly came to believe and find this out. Now, like I'm telling you, what had happened to me in my experience of drinking, this drinking business, and to me, this drinking business, my qualifications are, I started to drink, I liked what happened to me when I drank, I became a person that, I want to tell you a little bit about my home life. It has nothing to do with me being an alcoholic, but I was raised in a family where there was some kind of a, I wouldn't say, there was a lot of dissension going on. My father drank. He was a steel worker down from Pittsburgh area. That was a big thing. I don't know if it is up here in Ohio, but the steel mills were booming, and my father was very busy, and Saturday mornings was always a very happy time in my father's mind. And we were, you know, there was like an older sister. She was adopted, and then myself, I'm the firstborn child, my younger brother and my younger sister. And my mother was always having a resentment on Saturday morning because she knew what my dad was up to. He was spit shine in his shoes, and he was real happy because he was going out Saturday night because he deserved to drink because he worked in the mill. And he sold shoes on the side and candy or whatever he did just to get the heck away from the family, because he made us three children, and he didn't know how to be a dad. And that's what he did, is he ran. He ran from his responsibilities. And today I do love my father, and I don't speak harshly of him. I love him as he is and accept him as he is. But the reality is, he ran and he took off. And being a little girl, I've seen a lot of fights around alcohol. And we were raised Catholic, and I am a recovering Catholic. Also, you know, and the reality is that we were raised, and we went to the Catholic school and the first Holy Communion, all that stuff, first confession. And I remember I was always a very, very self-conscious and very a fearful child. I was afraid of everything. I had phobias and fears, you named it, I had it. If I didn't have it, I made them up, or I thought about them long enough. And growing up, my mom and dad were doing a lot of fighting, and I always had these fears that you know, we wouldn't wake up in the morning. And there was not that much of violence, but, you know, you don't know what your fighting does to children. And when they, when there's dissension in the household, and I was really afraid that we would, like, never wake up. I thought we'd have our heads chopped off, and I had all kinds of horrible, horrible things in my mind, you know, about this drinking stuff. And then my father, of course, had his novena built up in the cellar. It was his novena altar with a prayers and the candles and the rosary beads. And so when he came in on Saturday night, he did penance Sunday morning in that cellar. And it was very quiet because he was very hungover. And we really, as children, we kind of towed the line and walked the line. And when things got real, real bad, what happened was Dad took off. And back in the 60s, early 70s, that was not like really a hip thing to do, is to be a single mom with three kids. And that was not really what was going on at those days. In those times, usually you hung in together and you killed each other. And that's how it happened. And my mother just thought the best of the family is to say to my father, maybe you ought to go live with your mother. And that's what happened. And we went to go live. We lived in a very nice neighborhood, not high class or very richy or anything like that, because my dad was a steel worker. And we ended up going to this project, and I remember going into this project, and I was like totally culture shocked. I was like, you know, I remember walking into the project. I had never seen a black person. I had never seen a Mexican person. There were fights in the street. There were fight. I mean, there were gang fights. I didn't know what was going on. I mean, it was like, if you remember, what was that movie? But the fights, I can't remember. Was it the Lords of Flatbush or whatever? They just showed, oh, West Side Story. That's what I thought of this place where I lived. It was West Side Story, and it was called Pleasant View. And Pleasant View. And I remember this first night we moved in there, this guy got his ear chopped off, and I said, wow, this is really exciting. I can't wait till the next night to see what happens. And I had not yet taken the first drink yet, you know, and the following, like I would say, within the next couple months, as we like got used to being in this new environment, what had happened to us was we had settled in, and we'd go to visit Dad, and we'd see him on the Sundays, and he would, of course, be not too receptive to the kids, and we were basically mama's children, you know what I mean? And my mom was a very hard worker. She cleaned houses for the rich, and I always liked that because we would go to their houses and we'd get to ride their horses, and I got the bags of clothes that the rich girls threw out with the price tags on, and I thought that was really fashionable. I thought that was great, and I loved every bit of it. And I was never ashamed of it, and I was never ashamed of my mom, but, you know, my mom was ashamed of her, you know, her situation, but she did the best she could. And that's not why I drank. Bottom line is the feelings were starting to accumulate here. I was feeling bad about myself, Marianne Columban, okay, that's my maiden name, but my married name, I'm divorced now, is Dietrich, and I carry that name today. And I was feeling real bad about myself, and one day I woke up, and out of the nowhere, I had a grand mal seizure, and my mother found me underneath the floor, underneath the coffee table on the floor, and she had no idea what was happening and why I was the way I was, and she had never seen anything like this before. And when the paramedics came to rescue me, what had happened was they thought I was on some kind of a drugs or drank or something. And here I had what they call an arteriovenous malformation, which is a bleed in my brain. But what happened was they didn't diagnose it at that time, but I continued to have headaches and seizures for about a year. And they didn't want to operate on me because I would be paralyzed on my left side. I have weakness still on my left side of my body, but what had happened was for a whole year I took a lot of medication. I was isolated from my friends. I felt like I was missing out on my peer pressure, and I sat alone a lot in my bedroom and listened to this hard rock station called WDVE from Pittsburgh, and I remember burning candles. I was really a psychedelic child back in those days. I had real long hair parted in the middle and long down to my waist, and I was preparing for this, starting to, you know, this drinking thing. And what had happened was, finally, after a year, I had the surgery, and I lived. And most people would not live of what kind of surgery I had. I had two bleeds inside the brain. and here I am normal, somewhat normal. And the reality is, while all this was going on, all my girlfriends were going to dances and having boyfriends, and I felt very different. And I had these seizures, and your friends don't want to be around you when you have seizures, especially the ones that I had. They were, like, terrible. I mean, fall on the floor, and, you know, you just really kind of make an ass out of yourself is what happens. And that's what happened when I got drunk, too, you know. And so bottom line is, while this was all going on, and I had this surgery, I recovered from the surgery, and I'm trying to think. About 6 months later, all my girlfriends decided that it was time for me to go out and just start meeting the boys, you know, and I had that beautiful, long, beautiful brown hair, and it was all shaved off. I was as bald as an eagle. Well, I had hair maybe about, like, as long as mine is now, maybe a little shorter, and the reality is, I was so proud to be alive and so happy and so joyous because I had crossed over. When I was very sick after that surgery, I had died. I had had a cardiac arrest, and I went actually to the other side, not with the angels and wings and things like that, but there was a circle, like we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, where we hold our hands together and we say our Father and stuff, and it was like a beautiful experience. And the people that I loved in my life, people that were dead and living, were all holding hands and kind of pulling for me, and I came back here to be here in Alcoholics Anonymous, and not to be an inspiration to you, possibly, maybe. You either love me or you hate me, and that's the way it goes, but I am an inspiration to me, and that's the most important thing, and that's all there is, the bottom line in a nutshell. Well, when this little girl finally got her ideas about what this was about with boys and drinking, I started to proceed to go on to my first drink, and my first drink was one that made me drunk, and I really didn't care from the very beginning. I had no real good feelings about myself. I was always feeling like the ugly duckling, but when I drank that first drink, I became the swan. I was floating along that pond, and I became beautiful. I've always felt very ugly. I always felt less than, and when I drank that first drink, I became beautiful. And the alcohol lied to me, and it lied to me 100 times, and it lied to me to the point where at the age of 17 and a half, and a lot of people say, I can't believe that you could have been done. Well, yes, I was. And I don't question that today. I don't put it question mark where God has put the period. And at 17 and a half, I was in a locked psychiatric unit for my third time, and I had a knife at my mother's jugular vein in a blackout. And by the grace of God, you know, I didn't take her life. I would have, because I was a real nut when I drank or used any other chemicals along with that. And out of respect to Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't mention all that because it's not real important. It's just that I drank, and when I drank, I became an animal. And today, God has given me a beautiful life. Along with that beautiful life, there has come some struggles, and that's just the way it goes. I didn't walk in Alcoholics Anonymous swinging my purse around and saying, oh, gee, whippy, I'm happy to be here and happy to be sober at 17 and a half. Believe me, I walked in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, just as everybody else, sick and tired of living the way that I lived. And the reality is, the miracle happened to me. I didn't go out and just do anything spectacular or wonderful, but I showed up and I was here. They said, bring the body and the mind will follow. And that's what I did, basically, in the first couple years. And believe me, there was not much of a mind to bring. There was a body to follow, but when I came here, I weighed 75 pounds. I had cigarette burns all over my arms, my back, and from falling asleep in the bed with the, you know, just being drunk. And I thought I was a real gift. I thought I was a real, you know, gorgeous thing. You know how alcohol lies to you. But anyways, when I came here, I started to get well physically. I started to get well mentally, and I started to get well spiritually. God played a very important key in my life. I had a lot of fears coming here in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was afraid of everything, everybody and everything. I started going to Phobics Anonymous or Emotions Anonymous because I was so afraid. I was afraid to go to Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about the things that I thought about because I thought you'd have me committed. I'd sit way in the back of the room, and I'd walk in and I'd say, you know, I have a seizure disorder. And they, like an old timer would be sitting there like, yeah, so? And I'd say, well, I have a tongue depressor in my sock, just in case. And they're like, that's good. Okay, in case you have a seizure, we'll get it out of your sock, we'll put it in your throat, and hopefully we'll save you. But I had lots and lots of fears, and I didn't know how to talk about these things. And being a young girl was really kind of genuinely hard, you know, because my peers were out there still. And genuinely, I just kind of found a new peer, and the new peer was a new friend. He was a fella. He became a friend, and then he became my boyfriend sober. And of course, you know, today, I don't know where they're getting all this stuff from, because if you read the big book, it doesn't say, don't have a relationship for a year. It doesn't say anything like that. It doesn't read, I don't read that there. It says, if you have a firm spiritual foundation, you know, you can go ahead and proceed with this boy-girl thing, you know, and as long as you don't drink, there you can be all right, you know what I mean? And I'm glad that there was no old-timers around telling me that, you know, if I have a relationship or I get laid, I'm going to get drunk. And because it certainly would have happened times 20 or whatever. And the reality is Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me room to grow. It's allowed me to be who I am. And whoever that is sometimes. I say whoever, you know. And this young fellow, we went to all these AA functions. We were like, he was 18 and I was 17. And we were just like with the teen queens of AA. And we had a blast together. And then we ended up to, we saw things different ways. He started telling me things like, you wear your dresses too short. And things like that. And I didn't like that because I was never a controlled type of person. And I thought, well, I don't think this is a good relationship for me. And I just ended up, I moved out of the area. And that's how I dealt with the ending of a relationship. I couldn't deal with ending a relationship. I just had to move out of the area. So that's what I did. And I ended up working at this rehab center, which was really a nasty thing to do because I ran, and I learned from running, and I learned from my pain. And as you grow in sobriety, you'll learn in your pain, and you'll learn from running because you can run, but you cannot hide in sobriety. Because when you look in the mirror, if you have any good sense at all about yourself and your sobriety, you cannot run from yourself. You know, you just know. You know the truth. The truth is inside you. And the truth will set you free, but first will make you miserable. And I was told to get busy on myself, and that was really hard because I had all the excuses. Well, I'm so young, and when they said talk about making these amends, looking at yourself, your moral inventory, I said, what did I do? I didn't have much time. No, I didn't, but the things that were there needed to be worked on. And the bottom line is that I still had to do what everybody else had to do to get to the place where I am today. There was no shortcuts, there was no easier, softer way. I tried, believe me. So anyways, like I said, in the very beginning, we do a lot of crazy things. But the bottom line is that I was told in the beginning was that if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. You can choose not to work the steps and be just as crazy as a bed bug. And that's what I consider nuts, is not using the steps. You're nuts. You're actually nuts when you don't use the steps. You think you're psycho, and you believe you're psycho, and you really, you know, you start acting psycho. You act as if. And I got busy. I got busy being very, very active, and I did some really crazy things sober. I got a secretaryship. I was only 19 years old, and it was Christmas time, and I was broke. And I stole the membership. Well, I didn't steal it and never return it, but I went to the group and said, listen, I spent the membership on Christmas presents for my family. And they said, well, now, there. Pay it back. And I did. And that was hard. You know, it was kind of humiliating to say that. Hey, listen, I'm a human being and I did do something that wasn't really right. But today, I don't carry memberships or I don't do any treasures. I don't do that. Just because I know it's so simple to stick that little dollar bill in there, because I just know myself. I just don't want to do that. Today, I just know my limits. And I got married in my first, let me see, my first marriage. I've been married and divorced twice in recovery. And my first marriage, my husband was 7 years older than myself, and I thought, well, we're good. he was Irish Catholic and I'm Hungarian Catholic, and I thought, well, this is all going to work. We went to confession, went to communion, we did the whole thing, priest, and had the AA wedding, and it was going to last forever and all that stuff. And I come home from work one night and he said, honey, I don't love you anymore, it's over. And I had no clue. I had no clue. I just thought he was just absorbed in his schooling. And I was sending him to school, and it was over. It was over. He found somebody at school, and I had no idea. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. And I thought, again, because I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous, these things don't happen because I've been sober for so amount of time or whatever. Bull. It does happen to us. And what we have to do is we have to get back to our foundation and what we believe to be right. And what we need to do, and that's first things first. And what I did was I grabbed my pillow and I ran home to my mom's because I didn't know where else to go. He didn't want me anymore. And I ran to my mother's, and within about 6 weeks he had called me. I was still wearing my wedding band and crying and moaning, oh, he doesn't love me, and when will it ever quit hurting? And my mother kept saying, in time, and I hate that word, in time, because that's what it takes, time. And the reality is, he called me on the phone and said, Denise is moving in with me. And I said, oh. And, you know, that was a real, not a humiliating thing, but it was, like, very shocking. And I was only 21 years old or 22 or something like that, and it was just something hard to deal with. And this was the man I put my hopes and dreams in. We were going to have a house. And he went to school first. I was going to school second, have the babies third. We had all things out of order, but the reality is the common bond was that we both were sober, but we didn't love each other the way we should have, and he loved somebody else, and I had to accept that, and that was really, really hard. And I had started to go on, and I had to go on with my life, and had to date and start dating, and that was really starting to date different fellas and try to be not like getting in a relationship, and that was easy in the beginning. But what happened was I found this one beautiful guy, and I fell in love with him, but he didn't love me back, and that's just the bottom line. Sometimes that happens in life. And he and I made a beautiful baby together, and I didn't know that this was going to happen, but it did. And he wasn't real happy about it, but I was. And I stood up to my commitment, and I believed that, you know, that I, you know, like with my Catholic upbringing, and I believed that I couldn't do any alternative motions, and I just believed in having a baby, and I was an unwed mom. And sometimes when you go to AA, there's a lot of things that we do. We have our defects, we have our problems with our character and things like that. But people go home and they may beat their wives, and they may talk a good talk here in AA, in the rooms. But the reality is you have to do the same thing. You have to talk it and walk it at the same time. And the reality is that, you know, sometimes it's a hard thing to do. And I had to stand up for what I believed in, and that was to have a baby and have a baby alone. And, you know, like some people, like I said, they go home and they eat and they make themselves sick. My sin was I had sex. Not sin, but, you know, the thing was I got caught in it. And my sins were obvious. They were right in front of me. They were right front and center. And I was not real sure about this. I was like 22 and a half years old or something like that. And I'm having a baby. I'm all alone, divorced. What a way to do it. What a way. You know, I had two babies on two divorces, and that's not intentional. It just happened. And so what happened in my seventh month of my pregnancy, you know, every young mother worries, every young mother fears that her baby's not going to have 10 fingers, 10 toes, and I just was really, like, scared to death. My sister was pregnant at the same time. Same thing had happened to her. Isn't that ironic? See, you don't have to be an alcoholic for these bad things to happen, but the same thing happened to her. Her fella dumped her. And she had a baby, like, 1 month before me. And her baby was moving all around and doing all these somersaults in her stomach, and I heard her talking about this, and I kept saying, there's something wrong. There's something not right. And I kept telling my doctor, and he says, you're being psychotic here because you're fine. And here they did an amniocentesis, and not an amnio. They first did a sonar. And in the sonar, my baby was breached. Her name is Megan. She's 16 years old. She's still my baby. She's my firstborn. She was breached. And in the sonar, she turned to the natural birth position, which gave them an idea about what was yet to come. and nothing had prepared me in sobriety and in life to deal with what was yet to come. And this doctor came into my room, just typical like scenario. He said to me, "Mary Ann, what would you say to me if I was to tell you that your child would not be normal and may not live past birth?" And you know, nothing prepared me for that pain, nothing at all. And the reality, and the most beautiful thing is the Alcoholics Anonymous and my sobriety has given me that I didn't know, I knew that it wasn't about having a drink or taking a drug about that, but it was a lot of pain. It was a lot of pain. And I was very disappointed, and I was very mad at God. You know, you want these things to happen, these good things in life, but it just sometimes doesn't happen. It's been a long road to hoe. With all these problems, I had to have the faith of a mustard seed. And what that was is that meant that I found out how very little faith I had at 6 years of sobriety. I was talking all this stuff and going to meetings, helping people, but I wasn't walking it. I was talking it, but not walking it, not believing it. Not. They say, first, it goes from your head to your heart. And that's what it has to do. It has to go from here to here. Because you can talk it all you want. Oh, sorry. You can talk it all you want, but it doesn't make a difference whether, you know, if you don't believe it, it's all talk. That's all it is, just air blowing. And I went to meetings, and a lot of you folks did not understand. Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole didn't understand what my prenatal needs were and what the problems were, and this baby may not be born alive, and all the fears that I had as a young mother, a mother that wasn't sure whether she wanted to be a mother, and now she's got a baby that's got a lot of things wrong. And why did you do this to me, God? And why did this happen? And, oh, what do I owe? What, you know, why, you know, why? And here we go back to that same thing, putting that question mark where God put it, period. February 14th, 1982, she was born. And for that, I will be forever grateful, because that child has made me grow as an individual. She was born with spina bifida and hydrocephalus, which, for most people out there that aren't like medically inclined, that means that she had a hole in her spine. You could see into her spinal cord, which means she was paralyzed from her waist down, and she had water on the brain. And it wasn't such an ugly sight, because I remember seeing that child when she was first born, her big, beautiful blue eyes like myself. And I was just so thankful to God to see her breathe. And I made a decision the day that she was born that if I was only to love her for 5 minutes, 5 days, or 5 years, so be it. Thy will be done. And that was the most hardest thing to do, and I still continue to do that to this day. And not all is rosy and peachy and keeny and wonderful from that point on. As the years had rolled on, she continued to deteriorate, and she became ventilator dependent, and she became oxygen dependent, and she became very, very sick. And it was a lot to bear, and I'm so thankful that I had Alcoholics Anonymous to come to. And I didn't have a whole lot of meetings to go to, because I couldn't be lugging around all that paraphernalia with me, and I couldn't, when I'm doing the hospital scene, sitting by the bedside at death's door, I couldn't do that. But I had Alcoholics Anonymous in my heart and in my gut, and I knew the bottom line was that it was going to be okay. I had that good foundation. You can build your house with a sand, and it doesn't stand, but I had it with the bricks. The bricks were laid, and the groundwork was done. And I'll tell you what, that gave me strength in the deepest and the darkest moments of my life and my existence with that girl. And five years later, I had been through another marriage, which was a mishap, and not a mishap, but these things happen. And I really wanted to make something work. I really do, you know. I still do to this day. I'm never going to give up. But nevertheless, I had been divorced second time, and then I met this really cute Italian guy, God. And he just was like, oh, he was so gorgeous. And I thought, he picked me of all things. Anyways, my little Angelo came to be, and my little Angelo was never to be. I mean, it was like very, like a miracle of God, and that's why I called him Angelo, my angel of light. And everybody said to me, "Mary Ann, you should never have another baby. Look at Megan. Look what you've got to deal with. You've got so much in your life. You're so busy. You have all this stress." But I had this inner core belief that I would be okay and that this baby would be fine. And my baby boy was born perfectly fine, and he was normal. And, you know, everybody wanted me to, you know, terminate and say forget it and be a scared, and I wouldn't be afraid because I was brought up, you know, in the sunlight of the spirit here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You made me grow through all the things that I needed to grow through, and for that I'm always grateful. But this little boy, he's something. I mean, that was a scary thing because I didn't know what to do with a child that moved around. I had a child in a chair. She just stayed there. And I, you know, she just stayed in a chair, in a wheelchair, or in one of the sassy seat, and she just stayed there. She didn't move. I mean, she moved her arms and stuff in her head, but nothing else moved, and she didn't go anywhere, and I didn't have to childproof, and I didn't have to worry about my house. And I remember my sister saying to me, and, you know, people don't think before they speak, and you have to be very careful of the things that you say before you say them. And my sister said, you know, that Mary, she's so lucky. Her house is always clean. And she had a couple kids underneath her feet all the time, and her house was never clean, still isn't clean to this day. And she's still mad at me. But anyway, you can't have a clean house with children. It's just stupid. Why? Why? Have fun with them now. You know what I mean? But nevertheless, she used to say, well, you know, she'd say to my mother, she's so clean, everything's in order. But my mother said, look at her trade-off. Look at her trade-off. Look what she has to deal with. Diaper changes for 16 years, catheterizations, all the things that she has to deal with. What a trade-off for a clean house. And really, when you look at some man's other problems, you just say, well, okay. So then my sister kind of laid off on that clean house crap. And the reality is, you know, I would rather have a kid moving around and swallowing Advil and falling down steps than have a clean house that way. You know what I mean? But like I said, I don't regret the past at all. And even my recovery, I just don't regret that. It has always been a, you know, learning experience. Like I said, this little girl taught me about myself. And then this little boy comes along and they teach me some more, and there's some more to learn from your children. You learn so much from your kids. Today, I'd like to tell you that everything is wonderful. I'm happily married, and my life's in order, and I live in a house on the hill and white picket fence, and it's not like that. What I want to tell you about is in the last 2 years, I have suffered in immense insanity because we can go backwards in this program. Not drink, but not do anything else, you know what I mean? And the reality is that sometimes you just get in a stagnant position. You just don't do much growing. You kind of stay put. And I think that that's why I'm here today. That's why I think I'm keeping busy, and I want to stay active. And at 20 years of sobriety, this guy come up on a white Harley Davidson. And he said, I want to take you away from everything and everybody. And I said, I'll go for that. I'll take that. And his name was Gary, and I do love him, and I'll love him to the day I die. There's a part in my heart, I think we save places in our heart for every people that are very special to us, but Gary is now gone. I had met Gary. He said, listen, I want to be your man. I want to be your husband. He put a ring on my finger. He meant business. He wasn't talking, no insanity. He was a recovering person like myself, and he said, I want you to be my wife. And I said, okay. And we went to Florida, and we went on he used to tease me, and he said, I want you to go on our honeymoon before our wedding, which it was, and we never had a wedding. December 1st, 1996, he was an iron worker, and he went to work, and nothing had prepared me again for this day in my life. Gary fell 40 feet, and he died in the hole, as he always called it, the hole. I had never, ever experienced like that again, that pain, that loss, that frustration, that fear. My daughter was very, very sick at the time, and she's not living with me today. And she lives with my sister, her choice, and she was very, very sick, and she was dying. And only a week before that, I had went and said goodbye to her, you know, goodbye as a mother to a child, because she was in intensive care. She was on she was renal shutdown, full ventilative support, just very bad. And we had planned we would bury my daughter that following week because it was very looking very hopeless. But God seemed fit And why, I don't know. And I don't even question it any longer. I did at the beginning, but in my grief process, I had to let go. And what happened was we had planned to bury her. I went in and I said goodbye to my daughter. And I said, Megan, if you need to go with Jesus, it's okay. You don't have to stay here and hurt anymore. And go with God. And she has now still living. And a week later, you know, I get a phone call from my fiance's boss and says, Gary's hurt at the job. They don't tell you he dies. You know, they don't say that on the telephone. They come to the hospital, and I went to the hospital, and all the iron workers were standing there smoking cigarettes and just looking like they were out of their minds. And just, you know, seeing someone dead, yeah, that's a very big reality. And I walk in, and the guy grabs my hand, and he says, glad to meet you, and he shuffles me back in the room where they tell you someone's gone, and I didn't even know what was going to hit me at that point. And all I heard was his mother screaming, and his mother had not spoke with him for 3 months before his death, and it was a very painful time for their whole family. And the boss said to me, he said, Mary, Gary's gone. And I said, what? I said, you know, and not to make light of the death, but the reality is he was a big baby, and I bet you he probably ran out of the hospital because he didn't get medication, because that's how he was. And I thought that maybe that's what he was doing. And I said, why did he make me come all the way to the hospital, pick him up, and he's not even here? And that's how I was thinking. I didn't even believe it. And the doctor and the boss were standing beside me. He said, he's gone. And I felt like something had just, like a cannon had just hit me. And it got, I had a hole, like, so big. I couldn't even cry. And I said to the priest, and I said, may I go see my fiance? I said, we were to be married in 2 months. And he said, yeah, you may. And I went in and I saw him, and I kissed his head and I kissed his chest. And I told him that his mother and his father loved him and that I loved him. And those were the last words that I spoke. And I shut the door. I had to. There's no way I can explain to you how you say goodbye. I mean, in such a quick fashion. And he was always so proud of being the man that he was, the iron worker, you know, that tough persona, that cool, you know, that dirty stuff. And I still to this day love those dirty guys. I like dirty men. I mean, dirty, you know what I mean? Dirty, not filthy. They get work. They work and they get dirty. I think that's pretty nice. In fact, I was yelling at a few construction workers on the way up here. Hey, what makes you guys stay out here in this hot weather? Like, yes. And he goes, yeah. So anyway, nevertheless, when he died, I was proud. I was proud that he died the way he died. Not the death actual experience, but he was 44 years old. He was over 2 years, and, you know, it was a quick way to go. And he died instantly because he fell on his head. The last hour of work, they say, is the most dangerous. You never think safety, you know, and that's what he was not using his lanyards. And that was a hard thing to deal with. Because that morning, we had an argument, and that day, you know, I was just going to be a witch, and just not going to make up with him until he got home. I'll wait till you get home, sucker. And that's how I felt. But that day didn't come. So I couldn't say I'm sorry or I love you. So I had my closure and my time to be with him at that moment. And I was proud to see him all dirty and, you know, with his boots on and, you know, I know that probably sounds really morbid, but I was just proud to see him the way he was. And then I went home, and I thought, I called you, not you, but my group and my group of circle of friends, and it was hysterical. And I cried, and I thought my knees were going to fall out underneath me. I dropped 15 pounds like this, and I shook literally. I felt like I was back at day one of sobriety, and I kind of had to start all over again. It was not like I was using alcohol, but I just felt like a newcomer again. And you know what? The most beautiful thing is that I can still be a newcomer and come back and be just as hurt and just be as lonely and just be as full of despair at 20 years as well as 5 or 10 and come here and come back. That's the beauty of this program, is that I can come back here and be whatever I am, and you still manage to love me. You may not understand me, but you love me anyway. And the people came to the funeral, and I went through the motions, and I felt a lot of feelings, and I'm so like I said, when I talk about it, I get all jammed up. I remember the priest said to me when I was standing over my dead fiance's body, crying, I said, my daughter's dying. And I said, I didn't expect this. And he said, you know, Marianne, sometimes God takes one soul to leave another. And again, I was back there. Now, that's not fair. No, it isn't. You know what? A lot of things in life are not fair. And just because I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't make me immune from pain, hurt, heartbreak, or anything. And since in that time period, I had to, again, rejuvenate myself into Alcoholics Anonymous and become like the new guy on the block. And I had to recommit myself. And I went to meetings, got involved. And then a guy who thought more of me than I thought of myself at that particular point in time said to me, I think it's time you spoke at your first conference. And I said, no, I have nothing to give. I am totally weak. I'm totally done. You can't do this to me. And he said, oh, yeah, but you must go. You have something to say. You have something to give. And I said, I can't. I don't have it. I don't have nothing left. He said, well, you pull it up. He says, you carry the message and not the mess. And so, like I said, some days you just got to dress up and show up. And some days that's what I do. And some days I do have a lot to give. And this one particular fella gave a name to a man in Cleveland. And everybody knows probably Don C. from Cleveland, Ohio. And he's been around for like 37 years. And he's just as nutty as ever. And he don't mind me saying that. And I love him dearly. He's in Tennessee tonight. And he says, stick with me, baby. Your name will be in lights. So he's had me on the road. I've been to Jamestown, and I've been to Erie, and I've been to a couple different places, Cleveland, and it's kept me active, and it's kept me thinking, and it's kept me growing, and these are the things that I need in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want to get stagnant. I don't want to stay put, and I don't want to be just satisfied with, oh, I got a 20-year coin, or oh, I've got an 18-year-old coin, or whatever. I just want to be happy with what I have today, and sometimes it's just the basics. To thine own self be true. And some days, today, that's still hard to be true to yourself. I just turned 40. I turned 40 on the 24th of June. And my birthday and my anniversary are like simultaneous. So it's a really special time in my life. And it just, you know, my whole world has started to open up. I'm going to go to school, and I plan on being a full-time student if I can achieve that. I have some goals today. I have some dreams. My children are not living with me, but I am still a good mom. I went off to a retreat last weekend, and I went and talked to this so-called Catholic church priest, and I said, listen, I'm really angry at the church. I haven't been back. I haven't received my sacraments. I haven't done what I think I should do as a good Catholic. And he sat down, and we talked, and he said, Mary, I want you to realize that you are just a vessel. You're a vessel, and you can be angry, but you need to forgive in order to be forgiven. And that was a big lesson. It just shrunk me. It literally took me down. And I know that in order to be forgiven, you must forgive yourself too as well. And I went to my children and said, listen, I'm sorry if I've ever disappointed you as a mom. My son lives with his dad. He's his higher power. And I don't mean higher power, but sometimes you just got to give your children to someone that they respect. And my child was not respecting me, and my boy had to go where he was respecting his father, and that was just the best choice. And that's a hard decision for a mom, because I want to keep my baby with me. He's my boy. He's my baseball boy. You know, he's my pitcher. He's my right fielder, and I just, you know, he's my honey. And I want my Angelo with me, but I don't want my boy to grow up and be a delinquent either. So his dad has a firm hand on him, and he keeps him under the toe, and I get to be the weekend spoiling mom, and I like that. And but it gets lonely. It's because I've always been so busy. I've had, you know, Megan and Angelo and just all that stuff. But Alcoholics Anonymous, like I said, has kept me busy. And I'm so, like I said, being grateful is not enough. Saying you're grateful is not enough. It's in the walking and the talking of this whole thing. And that means driving 4.5 hours and baking like a chicken. Because you're going to meet some friends that you never met yet. and I know they're here. And, you know, like I said, God has been good. We had a very nice supper tonight. I plan on having a really nice weekend and forgetting about myself and forgetting about the problems that are around me. I know that we will go back to them, and they'll, you know, in my area, I don't know if you folks heard about on the news, but we have had no power. And talk about being powerless. I was trying to get ready. I take care of a man with Alzheimer's, and he's not able to be able to move around now. You know, he's so confused, and he's got dementia so bad that he just keeps going up and down steps and forgets to go to bed, and oh, he's bad. And the poor fella is very confused, and he's forgot to eat, and he can't remember my name. And just one day before I was to come here, the outage is on. 100,000 people in my side of the world over there it's like declared a state of emergency. You probably heard on it on the news. And no power. And so there's powerlessness. And I got to pack, and I got to get ready and get you know, things organized with my girlfriend over here, and we got to get going here. And with no lights, you know, I've got to hurry up and try to work in the day and get there at night and pack before there's no lights. And just crazy. And that, to me, just shows that, you know, the program does work if you allow it to work. You know, I didn't get too excited and upset about it. I had to throw all my food away, all my freezer stuff, everything, because I didn't know. Nobody told me, and I learned the hard way. I opened my refrigerator. Why? If you have no power, why would you open your refrigerator? But I did it, and I did, and someone said to me, if you open your refrigerator, you lost all your food. And I said, oh, now you tell me, so I'm done. So I had my girlfriend come over. Thank God for girlfriends. She came over, and she threw out all my food with me, and I'm so glad to at least have somewhere to come. I don't have to deal with the power outage. Now the lights are back on. They came on in time to pack. And I'm up at 1 o'clock in the morning trying to iron, and I was so dizzy, you know, from being tired and just running around, and just so glad, so glad. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me, like I said, it's a new meaning in your life. It's given me everything. It's given me a God that I don't really understand, but he understands me, or she. He or she. I don't know if it's a he or she, and I really don't care. All I know is it works if you allow it to work. If you stand in the way, it's not going to work. I know that the minute that I move out of the way, things happen for me. Things do happen if you get out of the way and you have the faith. And today I have a sponsor. My sponsor passed away with cancer 5 years ago, and I found a sponsor, and I don't have to call that sponsor on a daily basis, but lately I have been, and that's okay. That doesn't mean I have a bad program. That doesn't mean anything. It just means that I need to talk to somebody. And the bottom line is, at least I am not too proud here in Alcoholics Anonymous to say I need help, and I continue to do that, and I'm so thankful for that I continue to need help here. You know, my one girl that I sponsor said, I think you stay sober just in spite of to make everybody miserable and have resentment. Or something like that. And it really hit me. Like, I think what it was getting to her was she was seeing my weakness and she couldn't stand it. And it was making her uncomfortable because, wow, if you're that crazy when you're sober this long, you shouldn't be like that. Well, that's not true, because you can be just as crazy as you have to be, as long as you don't drink, period, and you are willing to change. And today I'm willing to change with the help of God and the help of you all. And I thank you very much for being an attentive audience, and have a great weekend.